Good afternoon. This is IRIS, the Iowa Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, where you can contact us at iowaradioreading.org or at 877-404-4747. And we are brought to you in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. This is Ken in his regular Friday reader seat, reading from the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Friday, August the 5th. And we begin with our first piece from Above the Fold on page 1. Autopsy results from Maquoketa killings released. Autopsy results released Thursday detail the violent manner of death. Three family members killed last month in their tent at Maquoketa Caves State Park. But questions remain in the case, including the motive of the suspected killer. Tyler Schmidt, 42, died from a gunshot wound and multiple sharp force injuries. His wife, Sarah Schmidt, 42, died from multiple sharp force injuries. And the couple's daughter, Lulu Schmidt, 6, died from a gunshot wound and strangulation, according to a press release issued by the Iowa Department of Public Safety. The Schmidt family resided in Cedar Falls and was camping at the park. The release states that all three deaths have been ruled as homicides. It was a violent crime, Jackson County Sheriff Brent Kilberg said Thursday, remarking on the autopsy results that indicated deaths by gunshots, stabbings, and strangulation. The suspected killer, Anthony Sherwin, 23, of La Vista, Nebraska, died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. His death has been ruled a suicide. Police found Sherwin's body outside the campground, but within a wooded area of the park. The release notes that all evidence collected to this point can substantiate Sherwin was the perpetrator of the homicides and acted alone. Tyler and Sarah Schmidt's 9-year-old son, Arlo, survived the July 22nd attack without injury. Arlo was initially in the tent at the beginning of the attack, said Mitch Mordvet, assistant director of the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, the state agency leading the investigation. Mordvet said autopsies can help investigators piece together clues in such cases. A lot of information can be gleaned and collected from autopsies and can provide agents with additional information and leads to investigate further, he said. Mordvet said that investigators have indications as to what the motive was, but probably would not release the information. I don't believe that we will out of respect for the family, he said. Kilberg said he was in contact last week with state investigators concerning the case. I was running some things down that needed to be checked, he said. I have 100% confidence in the DCI's investigation. Police have said Sherwin had no criminal history prior to the attack and appeared to target the Schmidt family members at random. Sherwin's parents, who had been camping with their son, expressed incomprehension that he would carry out such an attack. Sherwin's mother, Cecilia Sherwin, told the Associated Press in the days after the shooting that she and her husband were devastated by the attack on the Schmidts and by the loss of their son, whom she described as kind, sensitive, an exceptional student, and an aspiring businessman. Cecilia Sherwin said in an email Sunday to the AP that her family recently had made the decision to become gun owners only after a number of recent crimes and disturbances while camping previously. Neither I, my husband, nor Anthony had any experience with handguns before this year, she said. We took classes and joined a range. Anthony was very responsible and showed no interest in hurting anyone and never hurt an animal in his life. A memorial to celebrate the lives of the Schmidts was held Tuesday in Cedar Falls, drawing about 200 people. Continuing with our front page pieces, we have a large picture of what's pretty obvious to me, a lady daubing blue paint on her blue daubing stick on bingo cards all in front of her. And sure enough, beneath it, it reads, Audrey Lang marks her cards during bingo night at the Tri-State Independent Blind Society in Dubuque on Wednesday. The organization is celebrating 5 decades of serving the community. And our article reads, In 1972, a group of Tri-State area residents noticed a gap in services for people with low vision or blindness. My dad wanted to get something going for people that were blind around this area, said Debbie Gagne, current president of Tri-State Independent Blind Society. 10 people put $10 in, and that's how the organization started. 5 decades, multiple locations, and countless bingo cards later, the Dubuque organization is celebrating its 50th anniversary. The society offers a variety of services for blind people at its facility at 1068 Cedar Cross Road. Dad would be very proud because this organization was his life, Debbie said of her father, Don Gagne, who died in 2020 at age 90. It meant everything to him. Don Gagne began losing his sight in his 40s as a result of a genetic disorder called retinitis pigmentosa. His sister, Violet Haverland, also had the disorder and was one of the founders of Tri-State Independent Blind Society alongside him. We wanted something here so the blind had half a chance, Don Gagne said in a 2013 interview with the Telegraph Herald. Haverland, now 89 and of Lewisburg, Wisconsin, has served on the Society's board since its earliest days and is currently its vice president. She recalled how the Society, seeking a way to raise money for programming, opened a used bookstore and launched bingo nights. The two fundraisers became staples of Tri-State Blind as it moved from a building on White Street to facilities on 9th and Iowa Streets, Jackson Street, and Asbury Road. While we were in the building on Jackson, we marched in the Memorial Day parade a couple of times, and we did bingo at Dubuque Fest and America's River Festival, Haverland said. In 2018, the organization opened its current facility on Cedar Cross Road, where it continues to operate a bookstore and hold thrice-weekly bingo nights. Without bingo and without the bookstore, we would not exist because we wouldn't have the money to use to help people when they need help, said Ron Herrig of Dubuque, a longtime member of the Society's board. In the 1980s, Haverland attended the American Council of the Blind's annual conference, where she learned about other cities' low vision centers offering resources and medical services. Inspired by the event, she and other Tri-State Blind members launched a low vision center and recruited local optometrists to volunteer in the clinic, which operated for many years. Today, the Society operates a low vision store, which sells everything from Braille playing cards and dice to big button phones, sunglasses, and talking clocks or scales. On a recent morning, Mary Vargas, who has worked at Tri-State Blind since 2004, displayed some of the magnifying devices the store offers. When people come in, they tell me what their problems are with seeing, and I go from there, she said. A lot of times, they want to read, but their vision is so low they can't read a book, so I help them with that. In an adjoining room, employee Brianna Hansen staffed the bookstore, which sells donated books, puzzles, and games. The Dubuque resident also helps with Tri-State Blind programs, which include lessons in Braille and personal skills such as cooking. Hansen and other staff members also visit clients' homes for evaluations, assisting with tasks such as placing raised dots on the buttons of appliances so those with low vision can feel them. I think we give them that sense of independence back, Hansen said. When you become newly blind, it can feel like your life is over because we rely so heavily on our sight, but that's not the case. Blind people can do so many of the same things that sighted people can do, and we get to show them that. Tri-State Blind members also partake in weekly group outings to local parks, plays, or other forms of entertainment. Haverland enjoys these excursions, which allow her to socialize with others who also are blind and understand how they live. You don't have to think it's the end of the world because you have blindness, because there's so much that you can learn and do, she said. A blind person can do a lot of things if they're trained for it, and they can get trained easy enough if they want to. The Society has faced obstacles in recent years as bingo participation declined, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic. Debbie Gagne said bingo nights prior to the pandemic could draw up to 200 visitors, but that count fell below 100 when social distancing requirements limited attendees. Numbers now have rebounded slightly, with 140 to 180 players marking their bingo cards each Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday. When COVID hit, we really didn't think we were going to make 50 years, Hansen said. But what we're doing is good work, and people want to see us succeed. It's amazing to see it come this far. And we have another inset picture of a man behind a booth looking out at all the people playing bingo. And that caption reads, Calvin Key calls the numbers during bingo night on Wednesday at the Tri-State Independent Blind Society in Dubuque. And now we have our third and final front page piece, Stores Ready for Sales Tax Holiday. For families preparing to head back to school in the tri-state area, today kicks off an annual opportunity for savings on certain items. Iowa's annual sales tax holiday will take place today and Saturday, August 6th. On these dates, sales tax will not be charged on most types of clothing or footwear that cost less than $100. All businesses open on both days must participate. Certainly, there are costs incurred for families across the Dubuque area as kiddos head back to school in the next few weeks, said Molly Grover, president and CEO of Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce. Especially in light of increased prices and inflation, this is an opportunity for residents of the community to save a little on costs and expenses for families going back to school. Illinois also has a sales tax holiday this year, beginning today and running through August 14th. During this 10-day period, state sales tax is reduced by 5% on qualifying clothing and footwear under $125, as well as school supplies. Wisconsin is not among the states with a sales tax holiday this year. A press release from National Retail Federation states that an annual survey found 38% of consumers nationally plan to cut back on other spending to cover costs for the upcoming school year amid continued inflation. The release states that back-to-school shopping is expected to match the $37 billion in spending last year, which was a record high, and families plan to spend, on average, about $15 more than last year on school-related items. However, area business owners expect to see their usual, albeit busy, crowds for the sales tax holiday. Julie Berschler, owner of Gotta Have It, 315 Bluff Street, said the sales tax holiday always is a busy weekend for the store. People get to cash in on marked down clearance items and on top of it, pay no tax, she said. Plus, we have a lot of our fall items in, so they get to start their fall buying and pay no tax. But Bursler said it is hard to guess whether or not inflation will cause even more shoppers to take advantage of not having to pay sales tax on certain items. If I look back at the last several months, it has not affected us as of yet, she said. People still seem to be buying. We're very optimistic. However, she noted that higher gas prices might encourage more people to be strategic about where they shop and stick to local stores. Some of our out-of-town customers might take a short trip to Dubuque rather than far trips to other cities, Bursler said. We're working hard to keep our prices good, and hopefully people will continue to buy. Ben Graham, owner of Graham's Style Store, 890 Main Street, also said he did not think inflation would cause the tax-free weekend to be more successful than usual. I think it's just kind of part of their buying ritual or pattern, he said of the weekend. But maybe it's in the back of their mind that, oh, gas prices are higher. Maybe it would be nice to save a little bit. However, Andy Deckert, manager at Honest John's Emporium in Galena, Illinois, said she believed more people will be out shopping to take advantage of savings since prices of items have climbed. I definitely think people will be buying more, she said. I know a lot of stores are having sales, too, with 25% off to 35% off. At the Emporium, we have a lot of markdowns. Grover called the sales tax holiday a win-win for both business owners and consumers, noting that money spent at local businesses during the holiday will stay in the community. The tax-free holiday certainly increases traffic over that weekend, she added. Now we turn to some news from Dubuque and the tri-states, and at the top of that paper fold we have Dubuque Area Benefits from Fruits of Labor Harvest. Dubuque Area Labor Harvest's history of service in the tri-state area runs deep. The Labor Harvest, a volunteer-run food pantry, founded and led by current and former union members, has been serving Dubuque for 4 decades. The organization's roots date back to the early 1980s, when Dubuque was in the throes of an economic downturn. Dubuque had the state's highest unemployment rate at 23% between 1980 and 1983. Many of the jobless were union members who had been laid off by John Deere or the Dubuque Packing Company. Activists in local union leadership took notice and began organizing food drives for their members. We had people that were always concerned about the citizens of the community and their needs and pushed us to be involved, said Dan White, a retired member of UAW Local 94, who served as its president for 21 years. Those food drives eventually opened up to the general public and gradually became a regular event, according to Tom Townsend, treasurer for the Labor Harvest and Dubuque manager for IBEW Local 704. Today, the Labor Harvest gives away boxes of groceries to families in need every second Saturday of the month and serves hot breakfast other Saturdays of the month. The Labor Harvest served 289 breakfasts last week, Townsend said. The group also began delivering groceries to people's homes during the COVID-19 pandemic and continues to do so every first and third Saturday of the month. 20 to 25 people volunteer for the monthly grocery giveaway, Townsend said, while another 6 to 8 work on the weekly hot breakfast. Some 15 to 20 volunteers drive across the county to deliver groceries every other week. The organization's scope so far has been limited to Dubuque County, but members are prepared to deliver further, provided a volunteer is willing to make the drive. At this point, I haven't had any volunteers talk to me about gas costs, but I'm waiting, Townsend said, chuckling. Like many food banks in the tri-state area and nationwide, the labor harvest continues to face heightened demand as federal and state pandemic aid runs out. Now, that's pretty much dried up, and we're back to pre-COVID funding, and we're spending probably three times what we were before, Townsend said. Because of the large quantity of groceries the organization purchases on a weekly basis, Labor Harvest members prefer cash to donations of food. And the organization always is open to more volunteers. Anyone who wants to come down and help out, we're open to that, Townsend said. And we have one more tri-state piece. Southwest Wisconsin groundwater panel emphasizes importance of awareness testing from Platteville. Officials at a panel this week on groundwater contamination in Southwest Wisconsin emphasized the importance of increased awareness and testing. A small but engaged group gathered at the event hosted by Platteville Public Library to learn more about private well contamination and the results of the Southwest Wisconsin Groundwater and Geology Study. Researchers from University of Wisconsin-Madison and Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey tested 978 water samples taken in 2018 and 2019 from 816 private wells in Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette counties. Results showed that 33% of those wells were contaminated by nitrates or coliform bacteria, with contamination stemming from human wastewater, cattle manure, and chemical fertilizers, among other sources. Biologist and lead study researcher Joel Stutkin from the U.S. Geological Survey told attendees it is important for well owners to be aware of these risks, as owners are the ones who maintain and monitor their water. You're essentially your own utility company, he said. You decide when the well gets tested, what it gets tested for, and if you treat your water. Joe Bunnell, natural resource educator with University of Wisconsin Division of Extension, said wells in Southwest Wisconsin are at particular risk of contamination because of the region's fractured bedrock under relatively thin soils. Other potential risk factors include surrounding land use, well sitting, and characteristics such as well age and depth. There is no single cause of contamination, so there are many opportunities to address the issue, Stotkett said. Attendee Risper Nayaro asked panelists if there was a specific well depth that people should aim for to avoid groundwater contamination. Stotkett said the answer depends on certain geological factors and a well owner's attitude toward risk. It also has to do with weighing the costs of drilling a deeper well with the benefits of reducing the risk of contamination. If we want to recommend a depth, the first thing we have to do is determine what level of contamination or risk of contamination we're okay with, he said. That's not a scientific question, that's a societal question. Bunnell said that rather than coming up with a flat recommendation, it is best to consult with an expert to help determine how topography, geology, and other factors could affect the well. It's shocking that there's the potential that people could be drinking water contaminated by human waste, Nayaro said. But it was interesting to see how one well factor can make a difference. Other attendees asked what they should do if they are worried about well contamination. Bunnell highlighted local testing options, such as submitting a water sample to a local extension office. If you're asking, how do I know my water is safe to drink? The first step is to have it tested, he said. There's no other way to really know for sure. And now we turn to our opinion page, and today we have An Other View, this one by Craig Reber. Reber is a retired TH reporter, currently employed at Eagle Point Place Senior Living in Dubuque. He enjoys kayaking, bicycling, hiking, and swimming in his free time, and hopes to someday coach his grandson, Archie. And we'll see what that's all about because of what he writes about. And his other view, no-brainer to sell complex to Soccer Alliance. Youngsters and families, or condos and another strip mall? That's, in my opinion, the Dubuque Community School Board's dilemma. At question is the future of the Dubuque Soccer Complex. The Dubuque Soccer Alliance, which currently leases the property from the district, wants to purchase it. In January, an appraisal valued the soccer complex at $1.55 million. And in May, the Alliance gave the district a letter stating its intent to purchase the property at that value. Dubuque school leaders seek ways to reduce costs. Sale of the property can address that. Who to sell to get the most bang for the buck while pleasing the tax-paying public? Decisions, decisions. To me, school board, it's a no-brainer. Sell the property to the Alliance. The organization boasts dedicated individuals who care deeply about young people, their families, and the sport of soccer. I know through personal experience the significance and importance of the complex, a hub of humanity, energy, and spirit. I remember my daughter Kate, then 4 and a half, now 30, playing Recreation, America Youth Soccer Organization, soccer in the mid-1990s. At first, it overwhelmed her. 15 years later, a different story. At the time, I thought to myself, what a wonderful place to hang out during the summer. A few years later, when my then-wife Julie and I were registering Kate at the Kennedy Mall for the upcoming season, I had an encounter that would change my life. A rough-hewn guy, Jeff Ransom, approached me about coaching a team. I knew nothing about soccer, but Jeff, the head honcho of AYSO Region 419, had an effective way of communicating. I signed up to co-coach with a fellow, a stranger, Steve Savory, and a new chapter in my life began. I played pool, football, basketball, and golf in high school in the late 60s in Sioux City. Soccer was foreign, unheard of then. What developed was a love of the game, thanks in part to Jeff and others involved as volunteers for AYSO. Julie and I served on the AYSO board. I coached and refereed, ate numerous meals at the complex's concession stand with Dave, Mr. Soccer, Myers. He passed away too early at age 61 in 2007. Julie and I had fun. I enjoyed watching people of all ages, tots to seniors, having a pleasant evening at the complex. I loved the fact I was able to spend quality time with Kate. We even had a makeshift goal in our backyard, fashioned from a swing set. Kate booted balls. I was a goalkeeper. I enjoyed coaching other young ladies and spending time with their families. One team I coached, the Rockets, I fired bottle rockets after our games. I kept them in my equipment bag. I know I'm not the only one who enjoyed summers in the sun, the aroma of cut grass and Dave's concession stand, popcorn and burgers. If Dyersville can be Northeast Iowa's baseball mecca, ditto Dubuque for soccer. The Alliance, its humanity along with its drive, enthusiasm, creativity, love of children and their families, and the sport of soccer, can be a regional showcase. The school board has the opportunity to leave a legacy for generations. We have enough strip malls and apartment complexes. Do the right thing. You know what it is. This from a guy who will set his alarm to watch World Cup at 4 a.m. can still diagram drills and formations, and who has hinted at having, when the time comes but not too soon, his cremains scattered on the soccer complex fields. My memories are priceless. So are those of others. Preserve the jewel. And I'll put my momentary comment in there as well. My children grew up playing AYSO, one of the best things that ever happened to them. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. This is Ken, and I have been and will be continuing to read from the Friday, August 5th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And we now turn to today's obituaries. Robert M. Miller, Hazel Green. Robert M. Bob Miller, 92, of rural Hazel Green, passed away Tuesday, August 2nd, at the Galena Stouse Senior Care Community in Galena. Massive Christian burial will be 11 a.m. Saturday, August 6th, at St. Joseph's Catholic Church, Cincinnua, with Father Peter Auer officiating. Burial will be in the church cemetery, where military honors will be accorded by members of American Legion Post No. 787 of East Dubuque. Visitation will be from 8:45 to 10:45 a.m. on Saturday at the church. The Miller Funeral Home of East Dubuque is serving the family. Bob was born December 31st, 1929, in Menominee Township of Joe Davies County, Illinois, the son of Albert and Arletta Banfield Miller. He was united in marriage to Patricia Pat Green on November 12, 1955, at St. Mary's Church, Cascade. She preceded him in death September 26, 2009. Bob's life passion was farming and being on a tractor. Bob was a member of many card clubs with the love of his life, Pat. He especially loved a good game of euchre. He served in the United States Marine Corps during the Korean conflict. Bob was a member of American Legion Post No. 787 of East Dubuque and St. Joseph Parish, Cincinnua. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.millerfhed.com. Anne Renison. Anne E. Renison of Dubuque died August 3rd. There will be no services. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery. The Eaglehoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory is entrusted with arrangements. Robert F. Hall, Galena. Robert F. Hall, 83, of Galena, died Tuesday, August 2nd. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, August 9th, at Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena. Michael T. Sayer. Michael T. Sayer, 74, of Dubuque, died Tuesday, August 2nd. A prayer service will take place at 3 p.m. Sunday, August 7th, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road, where visitation will follow until 7 p.m. A massive Christian burial will take place at 10:30 a.m. Monday, August 8th, at St. Anthony's Catholic Church. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Ron Fangman, Dyersville. Ronald D. Fangman, 76, of Waterloo, formerly of Dyersville, died Monday, August 1st. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. Monday, August 8th, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. A massive Christian burial will take place at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, August 9th, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. Burial will be in the church cemetery. Eugene J. Faust, Sr., Zwingle. Eugene J. Faust, Sr., 93, of Zwingle, died Thursday, August 4th. Visitation will be held from 1 to 5 p.m. Sunday, August 7th, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. A Mass of Christian Burial will take place at 10 a.m. Monday, August 8th, at St. Joseph's Catholic Church, Key West. Michael J. Dillon. Michael J. Mike Dillon, 81, of Dubuque, passed away Sunday, July 31st, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, the home of the Hawkeyes, surrounded by his loving family. Mass of Christian Burial will be 10:30 a.m. Monday, August 8th, at the Church of the Resurrection. Please visit www.eaglehoffsiegertcasper.com to view the live stream. A visitation will be held from 3 to 6 p.m. Sunday, August 7th, at the Meadows Golf Club, 6525 Clover Lane, Dubuque. The Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 JFK Road, is entrusted with the arrangements. Michael was born December 10th, 1940, in Dubuque, the son of Larry and Ann Norton Dillon. He graduated from Loras Academy in 1959. In 1985, he married the love of his life, Donna Dillon. Before beginning his lifelong career at John Deere, Mike worked three jobs to support his family. After 42.5 years of employment, Mike retired from John Deere as supervisor. After retirement, he transported cars for Rundy Chevrolet. Mike was blessed with a high degree of athleticism. In 1988, he was inducted into the Softball Hall of Fame. He played for many teams in his 15-year career as an all-around player. He reached his peak with Dubuque Ready Mix as outfielder, who compiled a near 300 career batting average. In addition to softball, Mike had a passion for golf, tennis, and biking. He proudly participated in Ragbri for 7 years. When Mike wasn't playing sports, he was watching them. He enjoyed cheering on the Iowa Hawkeyes, Chicago Bears, Chicago Cubs, and the Dubuque Wallert Golden Eagles. Mike and Donna delighted in spending winters in Florida, going on cruises and traveling. His most memorable vacation was his trip to Ireland. Mike had a sense of humor that was unmatched. His hobbies included collecting golf balls and making his friends and family laugh. He lived his life to the fullest. A Michael J. Dillon Memorial Fund has been established. Wilma K. Billhorn, Manchester. Wilma K. Billhorn, 75, of Manchester, passed away Tuesday, August 2nd at Mercy Hospital in Cedar Rapids. In lieu of flowers and gifts, the family requests that donations be made to St. Jude's Children's Hospital. Online condolences may be sent to www.leonardmuellerfh.com. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m., Monday, August 8th, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Manchester, with Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. The service will be live-streamed at https://blessedtrinitycluster.com/livestream-mass. Visitation, 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, August 7th, at Leonard Mueller Funeral Home in Manchester. There will be no visitation prior to Mass at the church on Monday. Interment, St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery, Manchester. M. Georgine Pettinger, Worthington. M. Georgine Pettinger, 101, of Worthington, passed away Tuesday, August 2nd at Mercy One, Dyersville. Visitation for Georgine will be held after 10 a.m. Saturday, August 6th at St. Paul's Catholic Church in Worthington, where services will be held at 11 a.m. with Reverend Philip Aguirre presiding. Burial will follow at St. Paul Cemetery in Worthington. Georgine was born August 16, 1920, in Worthington, daughter of George and Alma Streit Tobin. She was united in marriage to Emil V. Pettinger, May 21, 1946. He preceded her in death, May 12, 1973. Georgine collected the Worthington News for the Cascade Pioneer and the Dyersville Commercial for the Worthington section of the papers for many years. Georgine was a member of the St. Paul's Parish in Worthington. She also served on the Worthington City Council as treasurer. Memorials may be given to St. Paul's Parish in Worthington in memory of Georgine Pettinger. Jerry E. Ryan. Jerry E. Ryan, 88, of Dubuque, died Thursday, August 4th. Visitation will be held at a later date. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, is assisting the family. Well, on this Friday, we have a lot of new little ones to welcome into our world, and so here are the births. Wednesday, August 3rd, Westhoff. Hunter and Tara Westhoff of Epworth, a boy at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. Ellison Greyer. Devante Ellison and Michaela Greyer of Dubuque, a girl, Unity Point Health, Findlay Hospital, Dubuque. Gall Cress. Brandon Gall and Holly Cress of Monticello, a girl at Findlay. Thursday, August 4th. Skull. Mitchell and Kara Skull of Piasta, a boy at Mercy One. Wilson, Luke and Kayla Wilson of Platteville, a girl at Mercy One. Welcome to our world, little ones, and may blessings shine upon each of you. Now we'll turn to a number of pieces of area news in brief. Our first one, police say woman threatened man with knife in Dubuque. Police said an Illinois woman pulled a knife on a Dubuque man and attempted to back over him with her vehicle. Ramika E. Wade, 28, of Chicago, was arrested at 12:19 p.m. Wednesday in the area of Riker and Valley Streets on charges of domestic assault while displaying a weapon, possession of marijuana, and interference with official acts. Court documents state that Wade assaulted Michael A. Sinclair, 35, of 279 Valley Street, the father of their five-year-old child. Sinclair told police he was walking in the 200 block of Valley Street around 4 p.m. Tuesday when Wade drove alongside him, exited her vehicle, and opened a folding knife while threatening Sinclair. Sinclair told police that Wade chased him while holding the knife, and he ran toward his residence. Wade returned to her vehicle, put it in reverse, and accelerated toward Sinclair. Sinclair believed Wade was attempting to run over him with her vehicle, documents state. Dubuque officials seek information on cat involved in biting incident. City of Dubuque health officials seek the public's help in obtaining information about a cat involved in a biting incident this week. The incident happened at about 7:30 p.m. Tuesday in the 2300 block of Queen Street, a press release states. Officials said the cat is a short-haired brown and black tabby. Health Services Department officials need help finding the cat to verify its health status and vaccination history, the release states. Officials ask that anyone with information about the incident contact the Health Services Department 563-589-4185 from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. or the Dubuque Law Enforcement Center at 563-589-4415 after hours or on the weekend. Authorities. Wisconsin woman presented another person's ID during arrest. Authorities said a Wisconsin woman arrested on a drunken driving charge last year near Dubuque provided another woman's identification information to authorities. Antiana B. Butler, 25, of Milwaukee, was arrested at 1:42 p.m. Wednesday at Dubuque Law Enforcement Center on warrants charging forgery, identity theft, obstructing prosecution, malicious prosecution, and failure to have a valid driver's license. Court documents state that Butler was arrested on a charge of operating while intoxicated on July 17, 2021, at the intersection of U.S. 61 and Southwest Arterial. During her arrest, she provided a Wisconsin driver's license belonging to another woman and identified herself as that woman, signing all related paperwork, citations, and jail booking information with the other woman's name, documents state. Butler's true identity only was revealed later, when the other woman contacted the Dubuque County Sheriff's Department asking why her license had been suspended in the state of Iowa. Authorities. 911 service outage hits Joe Davies County. From Galena. Authorities said a telephone network outage was affecting 911 service in Joe Davies County. Administrative phone lines were also affected at the Joe Davies County Sheriff's Department and Galena Police Department, according to a press release on Thursday. The release stated that local 911 calls were being rerouted to the Whiteside County Sheriff's Department. Residents were asked to contact the police department outside normal business hours or the Sheriff's Department for non-emergency calls at an alternate administrative line, 815-776-9310. The press release stated that providers were working to restore service. Carbon reduction competition open to Dubuque residents. Registration is open for a carbon reduction competition in Dubuque. Sustainable Dubuque's competition will include a 40-day program with steps that challenge everyday choices surrounding food, transportation, and other areas of environmental impact, according to a press release. Participants will choose alternative lifestyle choices for carbon reduction and track the environmental impact of their daily life, according to the release. Participants are encouraged to compete as teams with friends and neighbors. Registration for the competition is open until August 10th, and the competition runs August 15th through September 24th. The participants with the greatest carbon reduction receive either a dinner cruise on the American Lady or a shopping spree at the Dubuque Farmers Market. Visit sustainabledubuque.org/LCD or call 563-690-6038 for more information or to register. Beekeeping Basics event to be held in the Platteville Library. From Platteville. The Platteville Public Library will host a presentation on beekeeping this weekend. Beekeeper Scott Martin of Heartland Honey will be at the library from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, August 6th to help people learn the basics of beekeeping. The free event also will discuss the importance of bee pollination to the U.S. food supply, as well as how to promote bee-friendly habitats around homes. Registration is not required, but participants must be 16 or older. Well, here's a little tidbit I find, or found rather, that might be of interest. A good thing to go listen to. It's from the Lifestyle in Short part of the paper, Organist to Close Summer Organ Concert Offering at UD. Organist Jan Craybill will close the University of Dubuque Heritage Center's Summer Organ Sampler Concerts at 11:30 a.m. Thursday, August 18th in John and Alice Butler Hall Heritage Center. The Grammy Award-nominated organist maintains an active international concert schedule. She serves as conservator at Kansas City's Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts and organist in residence at the International Headquarters of Community of Christ in Independence, Missouri. Craybill has collaborated with ensembles including the Phoenix Chorale, Cantore Denver, and the Kansas City Symphony. Her solo work with the symphony was nominated for a Grammy Award in 2015. Summer Organ Sampler Concerts are 30-minute presentations that showcase the custom-crafted John and Alice Butler pipe organ. The concerts are free to attend with no ticket required and are held in cooperation with Cincinnati, Wisconsin Mound Center's Summer Organ Concert Series. Well, I'm going to try to go. I grew up with organ music. My father loved playing all kinds of records of organ music as I was a kid. And here we have another big tri-state piece. Countdown to MLB at the Field of Dreams. Players gear up for sequel game. Frank Schwindel realizes the sequel rarely measures up to a perfectly executed original. But he certainly will have fun trying. Schwindel and the Chicago Cubs will face the Cincinnati Reds on Thursday night, August 11th, in the second annual Major League Baseball game at the Field of Dreams in Dyersville, Iowa. On a postcard-worthy evening last August, Tim Anderson belted a two-run home run into the cornfield in right center field in the bottom of the ninth inning to lift the Chicago White Sox to a 9-8 victory over the New York Yankees in the inaugural Field of Dreams game. In the top of the ninth, all-star sluggers Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton had homered to give the Yankees the lead. "I don't know if we can top it," Schwindel, the Chicago Cubs first baseman, said during a Zoom meeting with the media on Wednesday afternoon. "You had Major League Baseball's best sluggers in Stanton and Judge go deep, and Tim Anderson hit one to win it. That's going to be tough to beat." "We're going to show up like it's any other day, play hard, and hope we put on a show for the fans. But it is going to be tough to beat." The inaugural game and its star power attracted 5.87 million television viewers, the largest regular season audience for an MLB game since 2005. Sports Business Journal later named it the best new event of 2021. Both the Cubs and the Reds entered Thursday's play at 20 games under the 500 mark. But the thought of playing next week in Dyersville energized players who most likely won't play meaningful baseball in September. "After watching it last year, everybody's excited to be a part of it," Reds shortstop Kyle Farmer said Wednesday. "I don't know if Kevin Cosner will be there again this year, but it was pretty cool watching him and Aaron Judge and all the players walk out of the corn. The coolest part was the scoreboard and watching guys manually going up there and changing the numbers. We never see that. I'm really looking forward to walking around where they built the original field and the movie set. I'm a big movie buff and I love watching movies, so I'm excited to be actually on a place where they had a movie being set. It was on TV two nights ago and I watched the whole thing. It's an incredible movie." Farmer understands the story behind the motion picture, too. For a high school assignment, the Atlanta native wrote a paper about the infamous Chicago Black Sox and Shoeless Joe Jackson, a central figure in the movie. The Black Sox conspired to throw the 1919 World Series to the Reds, and eight members of the team were eventually banished from Major League Baseball. In the 1989 film, farmer Ray Kinsella builds a baseball field in his cornfield to give Jackson and the Black Sox a place to play. "I don't really feel like a villain because I play for the Reds," Farmer said. "But if we do want to play that role, I can do it. That'd be pretty cool." Schwindel has played in Iowa before, first as a visitor with the Kansas City Royals AAA affiliate based in Omaha, and earlier this summer on an injury rehab assignment with the Iowa Cubs. Des Moines has hosted the Cubs' top minor league affiliate since 1981. "Obviously, there's no big league team there, but the fans are passionate," Schwindel said. "Iowa has some special fans over there, and it's going to be a great time to have them come out and watch big league baseball. We're very spoiled to play at Wrigley Field every day. because there's a lot of history, obviously. But it's going to be a great opportunity to play in the Field of Dreams game. We're going to try to soak it all in. The game day experience will be a little different for both teams. They will fly into Dubuque the day of the game, bus to Dyersville, and depart later in the evening for Cincinnati, where they will resume a three-game series. Typically, teams arrive in a city the night before a game. It might bring us back to our minor league bus days when we're traveling 8 to 10 hours a night to go from one city to another, like going from Omaha to Oklahoma City, Farmer said. We've played the Cubs a lot, so we're very familiar with them. In that aspect, it will be just another ball game. Every game counts, all 162 of them, but the different atmosphere will be a lot of fun. A couple of more pieces of news in brief. Another one that goes back to the Dubuque Soccer Complex. Alliance secures funding in hopes of purchasing the Dubuque Soccer Complex. A local organization says it has secured financing to submit a bid in hopes of purchasing the Dubuque Soccer Complex. Officials with Dubuque Soccer Alliance said in a press release Thursday that they have prepared a sealed bid to submit to the Dubuque Community School District to purchase the complex. The district currently is accepting bids on the property through August 18th. The Alliance currently leases the soccer complex from the district for $1 per year, though that lease expires May 2023. The property has been appraised at $1.55 million, and Alliance officials in May gave the district a letter stating that they intended to buy the property at that value. The release states that the Alliance's bid to purchase the complex is in line with what originally shared with the school district. If the Alliance's bid is successful, purchasing the land would be the first step in what we expect to be a multi-step process to improve and enhance the space the soccer community has called home for nearly 30 years, the release states. Future steps include offering an enhanced playing surface, longer hours of operation, and increased access. Next, Dubuque man sentenced to more than 3 years in federal prison on gun charges. A man who unlawfully possessed a firearm in Dubuque has been sentenced to more than 3 years in federal prison. Lorenzo Lemons, 29, of Dubuque, was sentenced in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids to 37 months imprisonment after pleading guilty in March to being a prohibited person in possession of a firearm. According to a press release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northeast District of Iowa, Lemons admitted on September 13th he fled from Dubuque police while in possession of a 9mm handgun. Lemons was previously convicted in Illinois of residential burglary in 2013 and retail theft in 2015. We are at the end of our time. This has been Ken reading from the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for August the 5th, representing IRIS, the Iowa Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Tune in again next Monday through Friday for more news from Dubuque.